Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. G'day everyone, and great to be back with you for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today we'll be discussing the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship conference recently held in London, multiculturalism, and the international situation regarding Israel and Ukraine and Russia. Tony, great to be back with you for another chat.
Dan, thanks for having me, and it's lovely to be back.
Fantastic. Well, let's kick off with this major global conference that was held in London over the past few days. It was headed up by Jordan Peterson and John Anderson. You were there with a number of Australians who were there as well. It's called the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, the ARC Forum, which is kind of meant to be the anti-Davos or the anti-WEF, if you like. And yeah. I think it was – I didn't have the opportunity – to go, but from what I saw following on social media and from people who have went, it was quite successful and interesting. So I thought, Tony, to start with, from your vantage point, if you could tell us a little bit about the conference, what it was and what you got out of it.
Well, Dan, it was a very important global gathering, dominated, I suppose, by people from the Anglosphere, but nevertheless with quite an international supporting group.
Yep.
Very important because this is a fraught time, and for quite a few years now, people who might be thought of as being not just on the political but on the cultural centre-right have felt that we've been in retreat, even eclipse, and yet the societies which have been shaped by Western civilization are I think beyond any real doubt, the freest, the fairest, the most prosperous, the best societies that humanity has yet devised. And yet too many of our own leaders, too many of our own elites have been extraordinarily self-critical. We've had the climate cult, we've had the gender fluidity push, we've had the magic pudding economics, we had for the best part of 3 years, the virus hysteria. Above all else, there's this cultural self-loathing which afflicts the West in general, but the Anglosphere in particular. And this conference was an important step against all of that. I like to think that this conference might turn out to be an important episode in the long countermarch through the institutions that we need if our Western culture and civilization is to continue to flourish in the future as it has in the past. So all credit to Jordan Peterson, who is the inspiration, to Baroness Philippa Stroud, quite a significant political intellectual in Britain who did the logistics. Great credit to Paul Marshall, a British businessman who provided most of the funding, and a particular credit to John Anderson, who was not just the Australian convener, but a very important member of the organising committee, and I think played a very substantial part in the actual conference itself. So it was at one level, I suppose, a rallying point. At another level, it was, a bit of an intellectual turning point, I hope. And at the very least, all of the 1,500 or so participants will go back to their normal lives, not just invigorated, but I think better equipped to make a difference for good. I had rather hoped that there might be a London declaration or something like a communique that came out of the conference. I think the organisers decided that it was too soon for something like that. I think they'd probably like to do another couple of these perhaps before they start to being too declarative and prescriptive. But it was a very substantial gathering of influential people, broadly of the centre-right, but by no means exclusively of the centre-right. And yes, I think a gale of fresh air in these troubling times.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I found most interesting was there was an emphasis on needing to tell a better story and a better narrative on our side.
Yeah.
I think over recent years, the centre-right has gotten used to playing defence.
Yes.
And that's been critical. For example, we defeated The Voice, which was very important.
Yeah.
I think net zero is going down. I think we're starting to see a bit of a shift politically and culturally. But I think we have lost over the last couple of decades the capacity to be on the front foot. So
mm-hmm.
I was heartened to see that there was an emphasis on we need to have a better story, particularly for young people who often seem to be captivated by progressive ideology, and understandably so in some cases. But I thought that was one of the key contributions.
I think that's right. We all need to feel not just that we are doing well, but that we are doing good, that we are doing right. And the left has certainly paraded its own moral virtue, I think in an entirely unjustified or in a normally unjustified way. I think that anything that brings about an overall increase in human well-being is an intensely virtuous thing to do. I can remember as a minister in the Howard government often saying things like the Howard government is the best friend that the workers of Australia have ever had. The Howard government is the best friend that Medicare has ever had. And I absolutely believed then and believe now that to be true. But the point is we weren't perceived to be on the side of goodness and decency. Sometimes I'm not sure we even believed in our own hearts that we were
yeah.
on the side of goodness and decency. But I am certain that we are, and we should be better at saying that, not in self-congratulatory or triumphalist ways, but in ways which indicate a quiet pride in the good things that we're doing. The interesting thing, Dan, about this conference is that it was by no means simply a political event. Sure, there were plenty of politicians there, including from Australia, a couple who are not your coalitionists, Misha Zelensky, who was a former senior official of the Australian Workers' Union, really should be a Labor Member of Parliament, but because of factional machinations has thus far missed out. He was there. Hugh McDermott, one of the senior backbenchers from the New South Wales Parliament, should be a minister in the Minns government. He was there. So it wasn't exclusively of the political centre-right, and it certainly wasn't predominantly a political gathering. Yes, there was talk of climate and energy policy. Yes, there was talk of family policy. Yes, there was talk of security policy and the proper role of business and so on. But in the end, this conference was much more about culture than it was about politics, certainly more about culture than about party politics. And interestingly, for a conference of this type, I think there was an important spiritual dimension, because as anyone who has spent much time reading Jordan Peterson's books or listening to his podcasts would know, he is a deeply spiritual man. He may not be conventionally spiritual, but he is deeply spiritual. And I have to say that listening to some of his talks, you did get the sense that he was channeling something very deep and very powerful. You almost got the sense sometimes that he was attempting to formulate something of the mind of the Almighty, at least as he perceived it.
Yeah, and you had the chance to go on Jordan's podcast, I saw as well, and I'd recommend that to our viewers and listeners. And you're on
GB News as well. Nothing surpasses the wild abbot podcast, but nevertheless.
It's got a good ring to
it. It does, Abbott. The Wild Abbott podcast, but nevertheless, that I did have a long and I thought fascinating discussion with Jordan, which he packaged to air just in the last few days.
Yes, I'd commend it to everyone watching this. Look, speaking of culture, we had our former Prime Minister, John Howard, who was at the conference. Mm-hmm. And he had some interesting comments about multiculturalism. And I want to get your thoughts on this. So what John Howard said is that multiculturalism is a concept that I've always had trouble with. I take the view that if people want to emigrate to a country, then they adopt the values and practices of that country. Howard went on to say, and in return, they're entitled to have the host citizenry respect their culture without trying to create some kind of federation of tribes and culture. You get into terrible trouble with that, end quote. I thought they were interesting comments. I know through the Howard years, he never really used the term multiculturalism. He kind of retired the word, but he didn't extinguish it or replace it. You were, as you just mentioned, a senior minister in the Howard government. And of course, your record on migration, including stopping the boats and securing sovereignty, is unsurpassed. I am interested in your observations on multiculturalism in Australia today, particularly in the context of those, I think, shocking scenes that we saw in Sydney with the Hamas protests not too long ago.
Well, Dan, John Howard should always be listened to with respect, because he was a surpassingly good Prime Minister, as well as being a very thoughtful and fundamentally decent human being. I think that there was a lot in what John was saying, but I would draw a distinction between the, I suppose, hard and soft multiculturalism. I was a fierce critic of multiculturalism 30 years ago when I was a journalist before going into Parliament. I then had, if you like, some interesting insights into the commitment of migrant Australians to this country in my time as Executive Director of Australians for Constitutional Monarchy. Some of the most passionate supporters of the Crown and our Constitution were not Anglo-Australians who might have, you'd think, a kind of a tribal commitment to it. They were people of Greek, Italian, Vietnamese, Chinese, Aboriginal background, who appreciated the strength and the stability that the Crown had given us. Yep. And it gradually dawned on me through my mixing with this really rather diverse group of Australians that our migrants come here to join us, not to change us. So that gave me a bit of a different perspective on multiculturalism as well. Yep. If multiculturalism is official encouragement to people from different ethnic backgrounds to stay separate, well, plainly, I think it's unwise to the point of folly. If multiculturalism just means that there's no expectation on people to forget their homeland, to abandon genial elements of their culture, if what it means in practice is that people are allowed to join Team Australia in their own way and at their own time, well, then I'm perfectly happy with it. So it is a reality that Australia is a multicultural country, and frankly, we have been a multicultural country from the very beginning. I would myself probably not stress the ism that much, like John Howard, but I think there is a fairly benign form of it. And in practice, whatever the, whatever officialdom might say or might fund, in practice, we know that every immigrant community has wanted to join Team Australia as quickly as possible. Otherwise, why would they have come? Now, I accept that there are some people a very, very small minority who sometimes let their homeland's passions get the better of them. And that's what I like to think has happened with some of these pro-Palestinian, in effect, pro-Hamas, in effect, anti-Zionist, even anti-Semitic protesters that we've seen lately. I think that a few of them have forgotten the reasons why they came here. They came here to leave behind all of those passions. They came here because this is a country where everyone is equal, where everyone should respect everyone else who is prepared to obey the law and do his or her best to become Australian. And certainly there should be no place in any decent society for the kind of race hatred that we've seen on the streets of Sydney, to a lesser extent on the streets of Melbourne, and yes, in quite a few Western capitals, including London, over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting issue because, look, my perspective on this is when you look at the size of the program at the moment, I think that adds another layer of complexity because it's quite, I was looking before our chat at just the number, the net overseas migration. And what you had basically from World War II, end of World War II, till about 2007 was a remarkably state. It was about between 80 and 90,000 a year.
Yeah.
And there was broadly a bipartisan consensus on that.
Now, 80,000 was a big number when our population was only 7 or 8 million.
That's, yeah.
But you're right. It was in that order up to 100,000.
Yeah.
Really until about 2005. It then started to increase at the end of the Howard era, mostly because the mining boom was driving demand for engineers, tradespeople and so on. And then, of course, under Kevin Rudd, the numbers just exploded to, in 1 year, I think it was 2012, over 300,000. Yeah. I pulled it back to under 200,000 in 2014 and 2015. But since then, it's taken off again. Yes, there was a pandemic pause, but now it's really massively accelerated and it looks like we're going to have close to 500,000 people.
Yeah, that's what it's on track for.
And that's a staggering number to think that we're bringing in a city the size of Canberra in a single year, and quite apart from any, integration issues, there's the sheer pressure on infrastructure, downward pressure on wages, upward pressure on housing costs, massive pressure on transport, both public and private. The Abbott government got illegal immigration under control by stopping the boats. What we really need to do now is get legal immigration under control by basically taking it out of the hands of universities and businesses that would rather import people than train up Australians or pay Australians enough to do the jobs that are needed. We've really got to reassert ourselves to be in sovereign control of our immigration system.
Yeah, I think you touched on something important. We know that this government is committed to 1.5 million migrants over the next 5 years, which is the biggest in our history in terms of the surge to our population. And I think you're right. I think a lot of big businesses have gotten lazy over the journey and say, well, we'll just bring in skilled people. Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough to a point, but this is putting a lot of pressure on our social services and on our economic infrastructure. Do you think that the size of the – so putting aside the multiculturalism issue, but just looking at the size of the program, do you think it needs to be reduced, the number that we're bringing in?
Look, I do think it should be reduced. I made a speech back in, I think, 2018 calling for immigration numbers to return to the average of the Howard era, which was just over 100,000. And I think that that would be a good figure today. And yes, there are lots of large businesses in particular which say they need to keep bringing people in to fill so-called skill shortages. Well, we saw during the pandemic when migration virtually stopped for 2 years, that our migrants, good people though they undoubtedly are, they're not brain surgeons and rocket scientists. The jobs that couldn't be filled when migration stopped were pickers, cleaners, drivers, carers, waiters.
Yep.
These are not skilled jobs. They're important jobs. They need to be done. But by and large, they're not skilled jobs. And the difficulty is that I suspect as much as anything because of the welfare system, and I suspect as much as anything because of the explosion in higher education,
yep.
There are a lot of jobs that Australians, frankly, don't want to do at the wages people are prepared to pay. And what we need, I think, is to perhaps look at paying people better and also perhaps look at the welfare system and do more of what was done under the Howard government, particularly when I was the employment minister, more actively insisting that people who can work do work, because at a time when there are supposedly upwards of 500,000 unfilled jobs, we still have about 1 million people on activity-tested unemployment benefits. And something is wrong. Something is wrong with our system when you've got 1 million people on unemployment benefits at a time when there are 500,000 jobs going begging.
And in addition to that, there's also the rules we have on pensioners and veterans around how much welfare they lose. I think it's about $225 a week. If they earn more than that, they lose 50 cents in the dollar on lost welfare payments.
And this is another one of the problems. And this was something that we grappled with back in the day of the Howard government. And it's something that I was certainly hoping to look at as part of the tax reform white paper process that my successor cancelled. The interaction between the tax system and the welfare yeah. system, because so many people, depending upon their family size, will pay punitive, effective marginal rates of tax at quite low incomes. So to go from welfare to work
yeah.
for quite a lot of people virtually leaves them no better off because of welfare withdrawal, clawback, welfare withdrawal, and tax increases.
Yep. No, it's something that I think desperately needs to be looked at.
At any given level of income, the system needs to ensure that you can earn an extra dollar and get to keep a decent percentage of it. And frankly, the percentage that you lose earning an extra dollar should never be more than 50%.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and ideally, it should yeah. never be more than 30%.
Yeah. Well, that'd be a good rule to implement. You say, look, whatever the rules are of the system, you're going to get at least 50 cents back at the dollar minimum, or something like that.
But that's going to involve a lot of re-engineering of the interaction between the welfare system and the tax system, or a lot of, if you like, a tailor-making of things to people's particular circumstances.
Great. Well, how about we move on to our last topic today, mm-hmm. which is the international situation. Mm-hmm. You and I have chatted about Ukraine, Russia. I don't think we've had the chance to have a chat about Israel and the situation in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So just very keen to hear your thoughts following the October 7 attack and the response from Israel. You know, just at a headline level, how do you assess the situation at the moment?
Dan, the October the 7th attack was an act of absolute barbarity and almost pure evil. To think that babies would be beheaded, that people would be massacred in front of their own family, almost indescribably horrific. So this was an act of pure evil, a premeditated act of pure evil, and Israel is quite right to be resolved on the elimination of Hamas. Now, one evil doesn't justify another, but there's a world of moral difference between deliberate, premeditated killing of civilians, where the death of civilians is the aim and the objective, and a military operation designed to target the leadership and the fighting assets of Hamas, which tragically is almost inevitably going to involve civilian deaths, because Hamas' whole modus operandi is to use civilians as human shields. Now, I can understand a degree of dismay at the civilian death toll in the current Israeli operation, but we have to appreciate that this is, in the end, Hamas's doing. The dead are not the prime responsibility of the Israeli Defense Forces. The dead are the prime responsibility of Hamas, which started this with this gruesome atrocity, which is wholly committed to the total destruction of Israel and the killing of millions of Jews, and which is using its own people as pawns in its own game. I mean, the real enemy of the people of Palestine is not the Israeli military. The real enemy of the people of Palestine is Hamas and all these other organizations that simply will not accept the right of Israel to exist behind secure borders as part of a genuine two-state solution. So look, I can't really comment on particular actions of the Israeli military because at this stage it's all shrouded in the fog of war. Obviously, we saw an example of the death cult's disinformation when a misfiring Hamas rocket was falsely branded as some kind of an Israeli atrocity.
Yeah.
And that's why I think we're wise to take many of the claims coming out of Gaza right now with a degree of skepticism, including some of the casualty figures which are coming out. I don't doubt that there are innocent civilians who are dying, and I think we should deeply regret that, and I think we should pray for their souls, frankly, because it is utterly tragic. But nevertheless, there is no easy way to defeat the evil which is Hamas, and yet it is vital for the long-term peace and well-being of the Middle East that Hamas be defeated.
Do you think it's possible in a practical sense to wipe out Hamas? Because my understanding is they also have a presence in other countries like Qatar, for example. Is it I completely understand the sentiment of wanting to wipe them out. Is there a risk, though, that this could then become much broader? And I'm just interested in your assessment there.
There is obviously a danger, and I suspect that some of the Hamas leaders have a death wish.
Yep.
I think there are elements of the death cult about this, and I think they're indifferent to their own fate. Maybe even they revel in what they think is martyrdom, and they think that the more of them that are killed, the more recruits to the cause they'll ultimately get. And I think that is something that we need to be conscious of. In the end, though, what we have to hope for is that amongst the Palestinians there may arise people of better character and nobler spirit. What we need to see amongst the Palestinians is perhaps a latter-day Nelson Mandela, a latter-day Tito, perhaps, a latter-day Gorbachev, perhaps, someone who understands that hate, in the end, does no one any good. And the only lasting way to bring about peace and a better life in that part of the world is for the Palestinians to accept that they will coexist with the Israelis. And interestingly, really the only people in the Palestinian controlled territories who are doing well, apart from the corrupt leadership, are those Palestinians who have got jobs inside Israel. It's several years since I was last in Israel, but at the time, GDP per head in Israel was something like $45,000, roughly the same as in Australia. GDP per head in the Palestinian Authority territory, the West Bank, was roughly $3,000. And yet, intrinsically, the land is no more productive in Israel than it is on the West Bank. It's just that Israel, because of the attitude of its people, because of the attitude of its government, because there was an attitude of getting things done as opposed to fomenting hatred and preparing for war, was just doing so much better. So if something of the spirit of live and let live, which has animated most of the people of Israel most of the time, could likewise animate most of the people of the Palestinian territories most of the time, by God, we'd have a much better world. But at the moment, any Palestinian leader who dares to contradict the ultra-militant line is almost certain to be killed.
And Tony, just to round this conversation off, I'd love to get your thoughts on the current situation in Ukraine and how that's developing. We've talked about that before. But
the big danger, Dan, is that the new focus on Israel will distract people from the ongoing importance of defeating Russian aggression. Now, I don't pretend that the Russian invaders have acted with quite the barbarity of the Hamas attackers. Nevertheless, there is no doubt that there has been atrocity after atrocity committed by the Russians in this completely unprovoked attack on Ukraine. And whatever defects or limitations the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian system might have, it is vital for the well-being of small countries everywhere that this monstrous bullying by a large country be resisted. And if I may say so, Dan, one of the things that I couldn't help but pick up at the ARC conference from some of the senior American participants is a dangerous recurrence of isolationism. Now, I absolutely understand that over the last 70 years, America has done an extraordinary job keeping the world safe for democracy, facilitating the peace and prosperity and increasing justice of so many other countries right around the world, including indeed in China. In a sense, other countries have benefited more than America has from America's strength and benevolence. I can understand the American people sometimes feeling that a lot has been asked of them. A lot has been asked of them. We have to accept that. Too many of us have been free riding on the Americans for too long. And yet, if America were to lay down the heavy burdens that it's carried, first of all, the world will be a much darker place. And second, in the long run, it will be much worse for America as well. It might be other countries that suffer most initially, but sooner or later, America itself will suffer if that manifest destiny that I think America has felt these last 70-odd years were to be surrendered or abandoned.
Well, Tony, on that note, I think we'll leave it there. Greatly appreciate your thoughts and insights as always, and looking forward to our chat in about a fortnight's time.
And hopefully, Dan, both of us will be over the Karadlergi by then.
I think you brought it back with you, Tony. Have a good one. This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.